آل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
First announcement by Yemen's Ansar al-Mu'min that the truce with the Saudi-led coalition had reached a dead end. Meanwhile, the U.S. thanked Saudi Arabia for extending the truce, not knowing the Yemeni government had refused to go ahead with a truce that did not progress and yield any meaningful results. Now, not surprisingly, there are reports of sporadic fighting in different parts of the country. In this edition of The Spotlight, we look at why there was not any progress in these talks. Why it failed? Was it due to the Saudis' economic stranglehold on the port city of Aden, for example, or were the Saudis and the backers just buying time throughout the time the ceasefire was in effect, and why? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us, political activist Fra Hughes joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fra Hughes, let me first start with you. We're looking at this UN-mediated ceasefire that took effect at this point from April, but now it has ended. The reasons behind it ending is something I'd like to ask you, because the way it was reported, it was as if the Ansar al-Mu'min said we're not going to continue with it, which in essence they didn't, but the reports didn't indicate why, which was, and your opinion matters, that they did not see any progress. They did not see anything coming back in return for any of the stated goals that they wanted in their minds. Why do you think this truce failed?
Yes, hello everybody. Well, I think what I've seen written down is that the Ansar al-Mu'min had asked for the total lifting of the siege to allow full humanitarian aid, full fuel ship deposits to come into the country, and an opportunity to alleviate the humanitarian crisis that has befallen the country because of the Saudi Arabian US-financed UAE bombing attacks on the country. So, I mean, it takes two people to come into ceasefire negotiations. It takes two people, two groups, two political ideologies to try and decide how to move that truce forward. But by telling the Ansar al-Mu'min that the Americans and the Saudis and the puppet Yemeni government were happy to have a cessation of the violence, which in itself would allow the Saudis, the UAE, and the Yemeni government to restock, to regroup, and to basically go again if that becomes their motive going forward. So I think the Ansar al-Mu'min are quite correct. I am not an advocate for violence. I don't want to see any more deaths in Yemen. But until there is a total ending of the siege and humanitarian aid and food and fuel and medicines are allowed to flow unhindered into the ports and into the airport. I'm not sure that the Ansarallah movement had any other option but to refuse to extend a ceasefire unless these conditions were met.
Well, the Yemeni government reason was about this blockade, that that was the main obstacle behind why this actually faltered and fell apart, basically, because it did not help a way forward in order to achieve peace between the two sides. Now, the question here is as to why Saudi Arabia or the Saudi-led coalition is, I'm not even too sure what's left of the coalition. Is it just the UAE? Mm-hmm. I think it's just the UAE. If there's any other country, I think they're the only ones left. Anyways, what is their problem there? I mean, if you think about the logistics, well, they could put on as many people in the, to man the ships, to use as security in order to check the goods or what have you, so they don't see anything suspicious flowing through. Because it's either that, or we're looking at what, 21 million people who are in dire need of basic goods and medicine.
Well, if we look at the tactics behind the siege, if you look at the siege on Gaza, that's not about the reported stopping weapons coming in from Iran or Hezbollah or any other member of the Axis of Resistance, because they could do exactly the same. In fact, I remember when the Mavia Marmara ship left Turkey, it had been searched by the Turkish government forces and customs, and it just had wheelchairs and medicines and artificial prosthetics to take to Gaza, yet that boat was boarded in international waters by Israeli commandos. So the siege is not about preventing weapons getting into the hands of your opponents. The siege is this unilateral coercive measure used in order to try and force regime change by physically making 21 million people starve, by telling the people that there is no other way except the Saudi way, and that if people don't adhere to the regime change policies and the reinstallment of the Saudi and American puppet Yemeni government, that all they can expect out of this is to die. And without the Ansarallah movement there to try and defend the people and reunify the country and remove this foreign ideological, financial and military occupation of their country, I think that the Hadi government or whoever they have in the wings to replace that would already be back in charge, and there would be no change, and people would still be starving, and the money would still be leaving the country. And in the proxy war with Iran through Yemen by Saudi Arabia and America and the French and the Germans and the British, I think, you know, that this isn't going to end anytime soon. And I think that the Ansarallah movement has stood bravely in the face of huge opposing forces.
Interesting. It's a very dark outlook looking forward from this point on. So let's welcome back Hossein Al-Bukhaiti. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, welcome. Looking at why this fragile ceasefire or truce failed, the ones that are reporting it, Western media are saying the Ansarallah movement didn't want it to continue. But it's not the case. They weren't getting anything back in return that was tangible enough for them to say, okay, we're reaching some results. Why do you think this was not continued by the Ansarallah movement, the ceasefire or truce?
It has been really clear that since Sana'a negotiation team has went to Kuwait or to Stockholm or and Geneva 1 and Geneva 2, they have been always putting a goal for Yemeni salaries to be paid to all Yemenis across Yemen. But it seems to be that the Saudi actually who is benefiting from the oil and gas revenue, as we know that 85% to 90% of Yemeni budget used to come from oil and gas revenue. But on the top of that, we've seen that the Saudi actually, they are taking those revenues and they are not paying the salaries of Yemenis. Sana'a demand actually is not for the good of Ansarullah, the Houthi movement. It's for the good of all Yemeni civilians as well. The blockade on Yemen, Saudi is continuing to block most of the fuel and food and medicine ship that's entering Hodeidah. They are as well didn't allow more flight to go out of Sana'a airport, especially Sana'a was promised from the United Nations that one of the flight will be going from Sana'a to Cairo because tens of thousands of Yemenis in urgent need of medical care, and they used to go to Cairo and Egypt before the war. And we see that this blockade on Yemen actually is affecting hundreds, millions of Yemeni civilians. More than 300,000 Yemeni civilians have died because of this blockade. The price of fuel has increased, and we see on the other hand that the Saudi and United States and as well many European countries like UK, France and Germany, they are actually keen for this truce to continue because of the war in Ukraine. They are afraid that if Sana'a will target Saudi oil infrastructure and United Arab Emirates oil infrastructure, that the price of gas and oil will increase in Europe. That's why they didn't want this to happen, because they do care about their population. But here in Sana'a, when they ask that those salaries must be paid, we see that the Saudi refused, and the United Nations actually is not doing anything. That they have been promising that they will see a way to pay the salaries, but still they are trying to use the blockade and as well blocking Yemenis from having the salaries as a weapons. And Sana'a, at this time, they will not accept that. They have agreed to extend this truce three times, and for the last 6 months, Saudi Arabia still sometime have targeted areas in Yemen with airstrike, like in Hudaydah and in Saada. They have delayed some of the flight. They have blocked many ships from entering Hudaydah. So this truce actually is only in the benefit of Saudi Arabia and in the benefit of Europe and as well United States, just for the gas and oil from the Gulf state to go easily those countries who are supporting the war. But I believe now Sana'a have the biggest chance actually to stop this war, because they should look at what's happening to the economy of many countries who are supporting this war, and they should actually make advantage from this war in Ukraine for Yemenis by targeting Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates oil infrastructure.
Well, Farah, we're trying to understand where both sides or each side is coming from. Now, in terms of Saudi Arabia, during the time that this truce was in effect, we're not seeing them create any type of momentum when it comes to any type of compromise, it appears. They have come out with a grand scheme. I think it was about 10 or 15 points of promises of millions, if not billions, of dollars for either infrastructure, transit routes, et cetera. But then, as our guest there just mentioned, when it comes to the oil revenues, no, they're not going to budge on that. They won't let, as the Supreme Political Council of Yemen said, for the Yemeni people to get the oil revenues and the gas resources. Or when it comes to the siege that we talked about, it doesn't budge on that either. So I think that gives the right for the Ansarullah movements or the official government of Yemen not to proceed with these talks.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree 100% with my comrade from Yemen. If we look even at the briefest history, slightly before the truce was inaugurated, it was the actual drone attacks on the Amroco facilities in Saudi Arabia and the threats of attacks on the oil infrastructure in the United Arab Emirates that appears to have been the kind of linchpin and catalyst that brought the Saudi puppet regime into the talks with the Ansarullah movement government. So, you know, obviously what's happened in my mind is they have offered an olive branch to the Ansarullah movement, but it was only ever there to deceive those people, to be delaying tactics. If they could have the ceasefire extended and extended and extended while offering very little or nothing or sound bites or some political document instead of tangibly raising and lifting the siege, tangibly paying the wages of the civil servants, allowing the oil revenue to be used for the good of the Yemeni people. What we have is, very obviously, as this conversation develops, Saudi Arabia is the imperialist interloper in Yemen, stealing the natural resources that belong to the Yemenis people. So the Ansarullah movement has every right to say the Saudis, the UAE, and the mercenaries who are there in their thousands have no right to be occupying Yemeni soil. the future of Yemen belongs to the Yemen people. It doesn't belong to America, France, Germany, the UK, Saudi Arabia, or the United Arab Emirates. They're not going to leave anytime soon. There's too much money involved. There's too much political intrigue. Yemen is seen to be a member of the Axis of Resistance. Therefore, it's a target for America, and it's a target for the EU. So, you know, we need to have a victory by the Ansar Allah movement. Otherwise, we will just have a continued war for as long as America and Saudi Arabia is happy to bomb infrastructure and civilians in Yemen.
But this is how this was this point was actually covered, Farahiz, where it said Yemen's internationally recognized government, via a tweet from its Washington embassy, urged the U.S. Security Council to deal firmly with the Ansar Allah movement over their latest threats and refusal to actually extend the ceasefire or the truce. First question that comes to mind here to ask you, is Yemen's internationally, quote, internationally recognized government located in Washington?
It's not located in Washington. I'm not even sure it's located in Yemen. I thought it was in exile in Riyadh when President Hadi kind of debunked there whenever he was under threat from a popular people-led revolution. But what it does maybe explain is that it's not the internationally recognized government of Yemen. It's not even the Saudi government, but it is the government in Washington. It is Joe Biden and his friends that are running the show the same way they are in Ukraine. This is just another geopolitical regional war being waged as part of a larger conflict between the American kind of exceptionalism and hegemony and New World Order and unipolar order. And they're just actually using the people of Yemen as the cannon fodder, as they are in Ukraine, against Russia, because it's a proxy war against Iran. And I do genuinely believe that unless, you know, the drone technology that the Ansar Allah movement has proved to possess is used against the oil infrastructure in these other countries, there will be no peace.
Well, listen, if you want to take a look at the U.S. position here, and might I add European countries in the mix also, we're looking at Saudi Arabia, where in the past months, minimum several months, maybe up to a year at this point, selling oil at $100 a barrel, average median. They're flush with cash. The latest news that we got on particular military sales was from Germany, where the German government approved the new arms export to Saudi Arabia. It had said that it would halt it, even the new coalition government, when it came into power in December, said we will not sell arms to Saudi Arabia. But they went ahead and they did it. So looking at other countries and the U.S., do you think that they are going to now start selling arms at a fast pace, given the fact that, you know, we're looking at this the kingdom flush with cash?
Well, I think it's quite possible. A six-month lull has been an opportunity for Saudi Arabia to replenish its stock of arms. I thought Joe Biden said after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi that Saudi Arabia was a pariah state and he would have no time and no truck and would spare no effort in putting Saudi Arabia out into the wilderness as a prowl on the world stage. And now, because of the fuel crisis, he's gone back to Saudi Arabia, he's gone back to the Gulf countries, he's begged them to increase production. So it's a double-edged sword, and it's a win-win for America and the EU. They get to sell their armaments at vast profits for their military-industrial complex. And at the same time, those weapons are used in a proxy war. So Americans aren't dying, Europeans aren't dying. It's Yemenis who are dying in this fight between basically the U.S. and what it sees as Iranian interests within the region. So the U.S. is a win-win. It gets all this money from Saudi Arabia. It sells them all the arms and all the weapons, and it allows those weapons to be used in its name to kill civilians in Yemen, which is a war crime. And there's absolutely no comeback against the American administration. And someone said recently America is involved in 76 different conflicts across the globe. I find that hard to believe, but if it is true, then that's just, it's immoral, it's unacceptable, and it's time American hegemony finished.
The date was September, the month that is, September 2022, not that far or a long time ago, Farahiz. And that was when it was the anniversary of Yemen's September 26th, what they called Revolution Day. And it was an awesome display that they showed in terms of their military might through various equipments. You mentioned drones. They put that on display, ballistic missiles, and a huge variety of different types of military equipment. I'm sure the Saudis took notice, never mind the millions that attended. That's one thing that always surprises many when it comes to these rallies different demonstrations. So many people show up in support of the Yemeni government. Anyways, if I'm Saudi Arabia looking at that, I would take note of that. Are we looking now that this truce seems to have ended, that we are entering or re-entering the war phase again? There have been reports of sporadic clashes in the past day.
I suppose to re-enter the war phase, if we're going to use that terminology, it takes one side to actually carry out a sustained military campaign with either rockets or artillery fire, mortars or planes. So until it reaches that level, sporadic fighting could just be regional kind of spats between the two separate combatants. But I think what we're looking at here is, like, from what I can see as an outsider, I'm definitely not someone who's fully conversed with what's happening in Yemen. But what I can see is that Saudi Arabia can destroy the infrastructure and murder countless hundreds of thousands of civilians, but they cannot win the war on the ground. I mean, that has been obvious since 2015. Now, the Ansar Allah movement does not really have an air force as such. It's all ground forces. It's brave revolutionaries and a people-led militia and former segments of the Yemeni army that is helping to fight and defend the Yemen kind of countryside and the constitution. So Yemen can't win the war on the ground. Saudi Arabia can't win the war on the ground. So you're just talking about a prolonged, unnecessary conflict where neither side, short of total victory from either side, is going to win. So either a national reconciliation government that has components of the whole country, which is left alone without interference from Saudi Arabia and the West, is allowed to come into being. I don't see there being any peace. But I do believe, as I've said, that the drone technology, it will level the battlefield entirely. And once or if there are attacks on the Saudi oil infrastructure and all of a sudden the production drops to 100,000 barrels a day, I think America will go in straight away and say, we need to end this conflict now because it is now affecting American strategic national interests, which is the flow of oil from the Middle East to West Asia, or from West Asia to the European Union.
Well, you have two factors there, and my final question to you. One is the Bab-el-Mandab Strait. The other is the fact that they have issued a warning. The Ansar movement has actually issued a warning, telling the oil companies in UAE and also in Saudi Arabia to basically to watch out because they could be targeted. Are we looking at those two areas actually being targets or something to break out there?
Well, I think in the short term, the Ansar Allah movement will just sit back and see exactly what the reaction is. I mean, if they're not going to prolong the truce, it doesn't mean they're automatically going back to war. They're just saying they are no longer involved in the peace process and the ceasefire, and that without the total lifting of the siege, that hostilities may resume. I would imagine that the Ansar Allah movement will sit back and wait and see what the response is from the Saudis and the Americans and take their lead from that. The Ansar Allah movement is not a terrorist organization. It's not deliberately targeting civilians. It's not on a war footing okay. Where it goes, we're not getting what we want, we're going back to war. So I think time will tell in the next 10 days.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, and thank you for sticking with us throughout this, Farahiz. We appreciate it. Farahiz from Belfast, political activist. And for the little time we had, Hossein Boukhaiti from Sana, we do appreciate it, activist and political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. It's goodbye from me and the team from the capital, Tehran. Until next time.
This is A to Z. an introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, faithfulness towards friend. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, I would like to share with you about a certain topic, an important topic, and that is faithfulness towards a friend. How important is faithfulness during any type of friendship or any type of relationship that we're having? Friendship needs faithfulness. Why? Because your friend or a friend that you're having is someone who you live together with in a long period of time. In a day, a human being can be living with friends maybe more than he is living with his friends. Because whenever you're leaving your house in the morning, you're going for the workplace, and you're staying at your workplace, let's say, like 12 hours, 15 hours, 24 hours, you're definitely living more with those people at the workplace than you are living with your family back at home. So this definitely shows that you need to have the right amount, the good amount of friends in your life. And whenever you have these particular friends, the one you're working with, the one you're playing with in the playground, in football, wherever it is, you need to practice faithfulness between you two, because the amount of quality time you're spending together is going to bring out more fruits if you're faithful with each other. Because faithfulness brings about good relationship, and good relationship brings about good results in life and definitely builds you to be a better person than you are. Whenever you leave in the morning, you come, you meet your friends, you sit with each other together, share your views with each other, share whatever you have with each other in a faithful manner. It's definitely going to make you two become better companions and be successful in your lives.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and we're talking about the faithfulness towards a friend and how important it is in our lives. We have examples of faithfulness in the lives of the Prophet, in the lives of the Imams, or the holy Imams. And one of the examples that we want to talk about of faithfulness is that of the holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. It was reported from him, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, that his wife Khadija, may Allah be pleased with her, had friends in her life. When Khadija died, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam used to remember her friends and presented them with gifts. It was reported that whenever he slaughtered a ram, he used to say, "Send it to the friends of Khadija." Then one day, Aisha asked him why he was doing this. He replied, "Because I love her friend." This surely shows us that a friend is he who is faithful to his friend and never abandons him at the time of difficulties and need. Faithfulness is really important during our relationship and our friendship. And he will never, whenever you do such like thing, such a faithful act, he will never forget you or forget your deed when he gets a social position. So faithfulness here, this particular happening, this particular story of the Prophet sharing things with the friends of Khadija shows that whenever you are faithful to someone, you aren't just looking at them. You're looking at them and the people he or she loves. You're looking at them and their families, their friends, the people they're living with, their colleagues. So being faithful to them means that you can help them whenever you have the ability to help them. And you can also not just help them, but you can help their friends too, their relations, their sons or daughters. And in this case, we realize that our relationship becomes bigger and better, and they won't be breaking as we see they do in our day-to-day life. So faithfulness is a practice that every person in whatever relationship he is in should practice in order for them to better their relationship. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next episode, inshallah, fi amanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
New jobs data in the United States showed a collapse of 1.1 million job openings, the biggest one-month crash ever outside of the COVID lockdown. It's also the first increase in the unemployment rate since April 2020, and that has many so-called recession deniers being forced to reconsider. The United States has had two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, which is the standard definition of economic recession. However, in an effort to avoid the negative press the recession label receives, the administration of President Joe Biden claimed that a stable unemployment rate meant that the U.S. was not in a recession. That's no longer possible. Due to the so-called Uberization of the United States economy, the official data has long been accused of falsely portraying a rosy picture. The national unemployment rate is 4%. But many say the jobs available are part-time, or lack crucial benefits like health care, or are poorly paid despite the current record inflation.
People looking for benefits, they want to work from home. People are not settling like they used to. It's just a matter of, I don't want to say laziness, but I think people are just they're trying to get the best that they want, and companies are trying to hold steady and their wages, and they're not willing to pay as much because costs are going up for them as well.
Amid the backfiring of Western sanctions on Russia, many businesses have responded by cutting job listings, slowing the hiring process, and may begin mass layoffs.
Now we've got the threat of recession, so some employers are cutting back on their hiring. My son-in-law just had to fire several people he had who were hiring people. So they're cutting back on their hiring process based on a precautionary measure, thinking there might be a recession.
The widespread perception is that America's central bank is forcing a recession to reduce inflation, even if that means throwing millions out of work, out of their homes, and guts pensions, which are usually based on the stock market. The drop in jobs is the latest piece of data which shows a dangerously worsening economic situation for the average American. Wages are losing ground to inflation at a record pace, and an economically chaotic October could translate into a painful holiday season for many. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
British police have released images of individuals they want to identify in connection with the recent anti-Iran riots opposite Iran's embassy in London. The London Metropolitan Police have already admitted that five officers were seriously injured during clashes with demonstrators on September the 25th. The protesters claimed to support Iranian woman Marza Amini, who collapsed at a police station in Tehran on September the 16th. A spokesperson for the Met said,
"We won't tolerate members of the public or officers who are doing all they can to maintain and regain order being injured in any circumstances. And we are now doing everything we can to make sure those who committed the violent offences are brought to justice."
Police are now guarding the embassy and consulate building, but other sites remain fearful of future attacks too. The Islamic Centre of England in Maida Vale was also targeted in the recent riots.
There's been so many cases where these so-called Iranians, these, you know, pro-Iranians have come and they've ripped off women's hijabs and they've beat up little girls and they've smashed in people's heads. It's just ridiculous.
The recent protests saw a hodgepodge of rival ideologies and dissident groups banding together. Many of these groups have a history of conducting violent attacks against Iranian expats living in the West. We witnessed supporters of the anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO, and former Shah dictatorship supporters verbally and physically assaulting Iranians attempting to vote in London back in June 2021.
I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. And it hit my trainer, a bit of it. And then they're calling names. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously you couldn't understand Farsi. He's telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now.
Calm has returned to London streets for the time being. However, many of the dissident groups which took part in the recent riots remain active and at large, acting as opportunists, willing to jump on any opportunity to harass ordinary Iranian expats and seemingly anyone else who stands in their way. Robert Carter, London.
On Wednesday, Italy's largest retailers association, Confcommercio, warned that over 120,000 small businesses risk shutting down in the first half of 2023. The association said firms are squeezed by the cost of living and skyrocketing energy prices. The president of Confcommercio, Carlo Sangalli, urged the government to do more to shield small and medium entrepreneurs, as the situation for many is now very critical.
There is the risk of a high number of business closures in the coming 9 months. Some small firms will simply find it more convenient to suspend their activity rather than losing 200 to 300 euros a day. Having said that, Italy will soon face a mild recession, which frankly is not as worrying as the media depict it.
Last month, Italy's outgoing government approved an aid package worth some 14 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. The measure came on top of over 50 billion euros already budgeted since January to soften the energy crisis in the country. However, the aid seems to be insufficient as an increasing number of businesses are struggling to stay afloat.
Everything costs at least 20% more. Energy prices keep soaring and it is very hard to keep going. We need help. The government must do something.
I cannot afford paying expenses for my family. I have four dependent children. They're all unemployed. Bills keep going up. How do we cope?
According to Confcommercio, more than 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of the energy crisis. Meanwhile, energy giant Eni announced that gas supplies to Italy from Russia have resumed after 4 days. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom cut off gas supplies to Italy on Saturday, citing a problem linked to regulatory changes in Austria. Italy's national energy regulator, ARERA, warned last week that prices would climb by almost 60% by the end of the year, but experts argue that its estimate was optimistic. Bills have risen by 93% in Italy over the past 2 years, and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, together with the damage recently sustained by Nord Stream pipelines, is likely to push costs even higher. Max Civioli, Rome.
Back on October 3, 2015, this Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz was reduced to rubble after being hit by a U.S. deadly airstrike. 211 shells were fired in the strike, lasting almost 1 hour. The charity hospital later announced that 42 civilians, including staffers and patients, were killed, and dozens of others were wounded.
Throughout the NATO coalition presence in Afghanistan, there were a lot of blind airstrikes and rights violations against Afghan civilians, especially by American air forces. The 2015 attack on Kunduz Charity Hospital was one of those atrocities and the biggest of its kind. As I remember, it was so deadly and devastating. Hospitals in war zones are protected under the 4th Geneva Convention, and attacks on them should be tried as a war crime.
After initially denying the building being targeted, the U.S. eventually claimed responsibility for the airstrikes, justifying that it had been a serious and tragic mistake.
Independently and impartially.
The MSF called it a breach of international humanitarian law and a war crime, demanding for an independent probe. But an independent investigation or trial has never been conducted against the U.S. forces' atrocities.
The MSF and rights bodies believe that the U.S. deadly air raid on Charity Hospital could be prosecuted as a war crime, but the international courts and bodies failed to conduct a trial because they are controlled by arrogant powers. They are funded by those countries and obey them. Besides, the U.S. has never agreed to turn any of their service members over to an outside judicial body. As a result, the case of the Kunduz attack was shot by Washington with a mere discipline of some American personnel, and no one was criminally charged.
Throughout the two-decade U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, there had been more than 13,000 airstrikes conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed more than 4,000 people, including women and children. The U.S. airstrike on the Charity Hospital in Kunduz is one of the many instances of American forces' atrocities on Afghan soil. People here say the U.S. should be held accountable for crimes it has committed in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thank you.
Muslims in London were compelled to mobilize outside an Islamic center on Saturday following recent Islamophobic violence by anti-Iran protesters. On Sunday, the 25th of September, London witnessed an outpouring of anti-Muslim attacks as protesters claiming to support Mirza Amini were filmed attacking Shia Muslims commemorating Arba'in and the Iranian Islamic Center of England, following clashes with police outside Iran's embassy.
Last week, our mosque was attacked. Our procession was attacked. People were attacked that weren't even Iranian, had nothing, they didn't know anything about what was going on. And it impedes our freedom of religion in this country.
Protests over the death of Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fell to the floor at a police station on September the 16th, started shortly after her death was announced. Those protests soon turned into violent riots, with masked people attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism and desecrating religious sanctities, including hijab burnings. Dissident groups outside of Iran were quick to board the bandwagon, engaging in violent protests throughout Europe, especially in London and Paris.
We've got people not of an Iranian origin, but in fact of multinational origin who've come out here to direct their anger to these people who are loaded with anti-Islamic people, LGBT people, and all elements which are anti-Islam who've come out here to side with an event which has happened in Iran. But really, they don't care about that event.
A police presence remains outside the Islamic Center. The groups are continuing to target the site.
Saturday's demonstration passed by peacefully without any major incidents occurring. However, locals informed me that they remained deeply concerned that future attacks may take place. They also informed me that they were deeply frustrated at the local authorities who failed to protect the community. Robert Carter, London.
For the first time in a decade, a meeting of the EU-Israel Association Council has taken place to discuss issues such as the conflict in Ukraine, the energy crisis, and cooperation in the areas of trade and climate change.
Is there any common ground between Israel and the EU on the issue of the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, this is one of the issues in which certainly we disagree. And Prime Minister Lapid has been very vocal in expressing his disagreement with this process. But I have a mandate from the United Nations, and that's what I'm trying to do. By the time being, in any case, the negotiations are stalled.
Palestinian rights campaigners gathered outside the European Council building in Brussels, where the EU-Israel meeting was taking place. They asked, why is this suddenly happening after a 10-year break?
It's a good question. Why do we want to resume it now? Because we need the gas, or what is the reason? Even though, actually, the apartheid policy that Israel is implementing is increasing and is worsening every day. They're colonizing more, building more settlements.
Israeli army killed Palestinian guys and children every day. They steal homes in Jerusalem and West Bank. They expand their illegal settlements.
We see the EU as a colonial institution supporting and funding the existence of the settlements and the Israeli Zionist colony inside Palestine and over the rights of the Palestinian people.
It's perhaps noteworthy that there was no press conference following the EU-Israel Association Council. Therefore, journalists were unable to ask questions. Prior to this meeting, Human Rights Watch released a statement which says, instead of reciting empty platitudes, European officials should use the Association Council to finally condemn Israel's apartheid and persecution and make clear there will be meaningful consequences should the Israeli government not reverse course. Of course, this statement was ignored. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Energy, housing, and soaring prices across the board. Britain's cost of living crisis is worsening and people are suffering. Giovanni and his wife are two of over 1,000 protesters greeting the Conservative Party conference here in Birmingham.
They don't care about ordinary people. They just want to hold on to power and maximise their own purses and get as much money out for themselves as they possibly can. It's despicable.
Conservative Prime Minister Liz Truss's government has nailed its colors to the mast. Tax cuts favoring the rich, business enterprise zones, and billions to slow the rise of household energy bills, which have gone up again this week. But all of it uncosted, sending the markets into a meltdown. How will British taxpayers afford it?
People are absolutely terrified about what's going to happen to their mortgages. They're terrified about their energy bills. They're terrified about, generally, the cost of living. And yet, at the same time, for those on over £150,000 a year, they're going to get much better off as a result of this.
The PM has pledged her government will keep an iron grip on national finances as part of her commitment to sound money. The subtext, looming cuts to already struggling public services.
They always say that we've got to pay the price for their problems. They created these problems. They create the wars, they create the shortages, and then workers are meant to pay for that and divide ourselves amongst each other. We're not going to have that.
But Liz Truss and Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng say they're determined to hold their nerve, promising a medium-term fiscal plan and independent analysis. Not now, but in November. As Birmingham hosts the conference, the Welsh and Scottish administrations have demanded a crisis summit, while the Labour Party, now with a 33-point lead in the polls, says a government appointed solely by party members has no mandate.
The UK is in a financial crisis. Protests such as this one are drawing more and more people onto the streets nationwide, meaning the pressure on this government to deliver beyond the conference walls is reaching boiling point.
Liz Truss has never had a problem charming the party faithful, but it won't be just her allies watching. Grassroots pressure is rising. Change is on the horizon. Saeed Purizup, Birmingham.
Afghanistan is still reeling from Friday's bomb attack in a Shia neighborhood in Kabul that left dozens of people dead and scores of others wounded. One of the victims of the attack was 18-year-old Najiba, whose family is grieving her loss. Najiba's father says he had raised his daughter with great difficulties, but lost her in the blink of an eye.
I've had a great passion in educating my children. I'm illiterate, but love to see my children educated. However, I'm an ordinary worker, but I always supported them throughout their school with everything they needed. My daughter, Najiba, was so smart and intelligent. I was proud of her and loved her so much. I feel heartbroken that I'm not seeing her future and I've lost her forever.
Sakina Surosh, Najiba's sister and a social activist, says that systematic attacks on Shia mosques and schools must end. She calls on the UN to recognize such attacks as massacre.
My demand from the international bodies, especially the UN, is that the latest attack on Koj Educational Center and other onslaughts on Shia community must be recognized as massacre and Hazara genocide. These attacks are systematically targeting innocent people from a specific ethnic group. The UN should not neglect in this regard and must take practical steps to protect persecuted Hazaras.
Beside international bodies and human rights groups, Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council has called for an investigation into such attacks. The Council called on the global community to end their silence on the murders of Shia Hazaras in Afghanistan.
Afghan clerics strongly condemn the attack on education and innocent students. We seriously call on the Taliban to take urgent and practical actions for ensuring security for all, especially Hazara people. The organizers and financiers of such crimes should be brought to justice. The international community must end their silence on the plight of Hazara people in Afghanistan.
Rights groups say the Daesh terrorist group has been responsible for 13 attacks against Hazaras since the Taliban's return to power. The attacks have killed or wounded at least 700 people from the community. The latest bomb attack has shocked people here. They are calling on the international community not to turn a blind eye on the plight of Shia Hazaras in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Palestinians held a mass rally in the blockaded Gaza Strip to support Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds in the face of growing Israeli aggressions against the Holy City. People shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and slammed the silence of Arab countries on Israel's crimes in Al-Quds. Tensions have been on the rise in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers and Israeli forces desecrated the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
We're sending a clear message to the whole world that the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people are in a constant battle against the Israeli enemy and will not remain silent over aggressions against Al-Aqsa.
People from all walks of life gathered to express their support for resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks.
People in Gaza are attending this rally to affirm our support and full backing for the Palestinian resistance. We believe that armed resistance is key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
We are here to support Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's part of our faith, and we are willing to sacrifice our lives in order to protect it. Gaza will always defend Al-Quds, and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to protect Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
Palestinians say they will use all forms of resistance to protect Al-Aqsa Mosque and the holy city of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
In the limelight.
One of the main goals of Russia's special operation in Ukraine is to counter NATO's expansionist policies. And also, as President Vladimir Putin announced on the eve of the operation, he wants to denazify Ukraine from far-right extremists. But after the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine, Western countries, especially United States and Britain, are trying to inflame the fire of war by helping Ukraine with huge cargoes of arms and ammunition, and imposing extensive sanctions against Moscow. Recently, some sabotage happened in the Russian gas export pipelines to European countries, which caused gas leakage in the sea and blocked the flow of Russian gas to Europe. Russian officials have analyzed this and believe it to be an act of sabotage by the United States and British intelligence services. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The RIA Novosti news agency reported that Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters on Thursday, 29th of September, that the Nord Stream pipeline incident looks like a terrorist act on a state level. According to Dmitry Peskov, it is very difficult to imagine that such a terrorist act could take place without the involvement of some state. Peskov also said that even though Russia and the United States do not maintain substantive contact through their special services, the emergency situation with the Nord Stream gas pipeline requires active and operational cooperation. Peskov pointed out, "We do not have any substantive contact or cooperation between security agencies. However, the unprecedented nature of this event, it seems that this is such a terrorist act, perhaps at the state level, of course it requires very active and energetic cooperation. This is an extremely dangerous situation that requires urgent investigation." Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said the Nord Stream pipeline incidents took place in the exclusive economic zone of Denmark and Sweden. an area that is fully controlled by U.S. intelligence agencies. Commenting on the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline leaks on Wednesday, 28th of September, Maria Zakharova recalled that officials in Washington had asserted earlier this year that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline would never go into service. The Foreign Ministry spokeswoman demanded, among other things, that U.S. President Joe Biden issue a reply as to whether Washington had carried out its threat over the pipelines on 25th and 26th of September. On Tuesday, 27th of September, Nord Stream AG reported about unprecedented damage on Monday, 26th of September, that affected three lines of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines registered